This is the Multi-Faith Matters Podcast. I'm your host, John Morgan. Well, this is the podcast for Multi-Faith Matters. I'm the host, John Moorhead, and I'm privileged to have today a return guest, George Chrysides. George, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, thank you, John. It's good to see you again. We've never met in person, but I kind of feel I've got to know you now with these podcasts. So thanks for inviting me again.
But of course, I really enjoy your work. Let me just read a little bio line for you. We'll have this and information about our discussion in the podcast notes, but George is an honorary research fellow in the Department of Theology and Religious Studies at York St. John University in the UK. And in the past, we've discussed his expertise in Jehovah's Witnesses, and today we're going to be discussing his new book, which I've had the privilege of taking a look at. I don't know why Cambridge University Press made it available for a few days free for a PDF, but I'm always willing to take advantage of publishers making books available for free. And this one is titled Fieldwork in New Religious Movements, and it's part of the Cambridge Elements series on new religious movements. And I think it's an important book, and we're going to tease out elements of the book and try and make some application to the primary viewers of this podcast, that is evangelicals and other Christians. George, to begin with, what was the impetus for this book?
Well, the answer to that is rather boring. I was simply asked to do it. There's a series by Cambridge University Press of short books, and it is a short book. It's only 30,000 words, which is about a third of the length that you'd expect from your average book. But Cambridge has a series of elements, as they call them, that spans quite a huge variety of subjects. And new religious movements is one of these categories. So there are, I'm not sure exactly how many, but at least a dozen books in that series. And James R. Lewis, when he was alive, he unfortunately died a couple of years back, but he was the series editor, and he asked if I would be interested in doing fieldwork in new religious movements. So I've done quite a bit of fieldwork, so I said, fine. And then Jim wasn't well for quite a few years before his death, so nothing much happened in that period. And then Rebecca Moore took over. You possibly know Rebecca because she specializes in Jonestown, Jim Jones People's Temple. So she took over the editorship and was looking through the arrangements that Jim had made and asked if I was still interested. So the answer was yes. So that was the impetus for the book.
Okay. Well, whatever it takes to get a good book done, I'm glad it's there. Part of what we try and do with this podcast is to take scholarship and make it accessible to a non-academic audience. So what is field work? What does it look like? And then, so that it can become accessible to people and usable, is it possible to have an academic kind of field work? And what might that look like for a non-academic who's trying to learn from this process?
Yeah, well, field work, as I say in the book, is defined not just by me, but most people that do field work would define it as something that you don't get in a library or in a laboratory. It involves, well, you can do field work on animals and plants and so on. But in my line of business, obviously, it's dealing with people, because religion is about people. We've often focused on books in the past because I guess, like me, when you studied religion initially in the old days, it was all about texts and about getting to know the Bible and biblical scholarship. And that's not where people are at. So the function of fieldwork is to find out how people really practice their faith. Because I guess if you ask people to expound the book of Zechariah, for instance, most Christians wouldn't have a clue. They might know it was in the Bible, but that would be their limit. So it would be wrong to define people's religion by their sacred texts. They either don't know them, or maybe they interpret them differently from the way they've been practiced in the past. Because if you were to say to a Christian, "Look, you've got to kill homosexuals," because that's what the Bible says, I think most Christians would rightly be appalled by that. And how you deal with that text is another issue. But I think we would all say that we've moved on from there, and that we've got a different understanding of sexuality, for example. So how things move on is one aspect of field work. We want to know how people practice their faith now, rather than how they did 2 millennia ago.
So it's an emphasis on the lived religion aspect of it.
Yeah, lived religion, or sometimes people talk about vernacular religion. People in the past have sometimes used terms like folk religion, but it's generally reckoned that that's not so good. We're talking about vernacular religion, lived religion, how people live by their faith and how they understand it.
Does it have any similarities to what an anthropologist might do in terms of an ethnographic approach?
Yes, very much so. I've not been trained as an anthropologist. Religious studies is a kind of field of study that embraces anthropology, sociology, and also textual study, because I don't think you can ignore the texts. They're part of the phenomenon as well, and we need to take that aboard too.
You talk about in the book landmark studies. We've
Yeah.
talked about, what the process is. Can you just sketch some of the, just give some examples of these landmark studies so people have an idea of what's been done previously?
Right. Well, I identify four landmark studies in the book. The best known possibly is Festinger, Leon Festinger's work, which is called When Prophecy Fails. Now, that's a kind of landmark book. Everybody quotes it. Personally, I think it's a very bad book. A lot of work went into it, but I don't think it was terribly productive. If you don't know the book, then the book is about how Festinger and a number of his associates infiltrated the Sananda cult. It was a group that expected a huge flood to envelop the earth, and the only means of escape was by aliens who would come and rescue the righteous with a spaceship. I think that's it in a nutshell. Predictably, the prophecy didn't come to pass. And obviously, the researchers were expecting that. And their question was, how does a religion deal with failed prophecy? Now, I think there are a lot of objections to Festinger's work. I mean, one was that it was covert, and covert research tends not to be favored these days. It also, I think, gives a skewed view of what prophecy is. And unfortunately, this has been taken aboard by many sociologists. Prophecy equals predicting the future, equals predicting it wrongly. It fails, and you've got to explain it. Now, that's not even how groups like Jehovah's Witnesses understand prophecy. I think most Christians would say, well, yes, there's a predictive element, but prophecy means speaking forth. The Greek words pro and phemi, I speak forth, either as a prophet on behalf of God, if I'm a prophet, or God himself speaks his word. And certainly prophecy doesn't fail. Most religious groups have got explanations why things that they might seem to have predicted in the future haven't actually happened. If you look at the disciples after Jesus' resurrection, what they said was, if you look at the scriptures, you would see that this had to happen. So it was kind of retrodiction. They were taking prophecy and saying, well, see, the prophets had it right after all. We just didn't understand them particularly well. And it's a very nuanced concept, prophecy, and I think it's very wrong the way everyone has followed Festinger and said its field prediction.
So his was an example with kind of a UFO based
It was
group.
a UFO group, yes. So the other example that I take as a landmark study, not quite so well known because it was never made into a book, was Balch and Taylor's work on what became Heaven's Gate. And what they did, again, it was covert. They infiltrated Applewhite and Nettle's group. And it's a useful piece of research because they actually saw it through their early days and described what life was like and how it progressed. And I think it's a good answer to people that sometimes say, why on earth do you research these very small groups? And of course, the answer is, well, you never know what's going to happen to them. And it was very important when in 1997 it was reported that there had been these mass suicides in San Diego. Because when it was reported in the news, nobody, including myself, knew about the group. But fortunately, we had this research that we could look back on and then actually see what the group was about and maybe why they acted as they did.
You also reference some of Eileen Barker's work, if I recall.
Yes. Yeah, that was number four. In case listeners are wondering what number two was, number two was John Loughlin's Doomsday Cult, which again was about the early days of the Unification Church. So that's quite interesting too, because we've got a documented account of what it was like when missionaries first came to the United States. Actually, John doesn't name the group because I remember asking him about it some time ago, and he said, "Well, this is sociologists of sociology of deviance, and sociologists don't reveal the name of their informants unless it's necessary." So I think at the time they weren't envisaging that this group would make a huge impact. So again, that was useful. But you mentioned Eileen Barker, and of course that's a very good piece of research and very useful because she did a lot of field work in the Unification Church, and she looked at it in the days when it was controversial. Well, it still is controversial, but it was particularly highlighted in public as being a controversial so-called cult. And people were saying you wouldn't join unless you were brainwashed. And brainwashing theory was very much in vogue. And it still is among the critics of new religions. But Eileen's research showed that far from being brainwashed, people that inquired at the Unification Church were not at all likely to be prone to join. It was something like, and I need to get the book out to quote the exact statistic, but it was something like 0.02% of inquirers were still in the church after 2 years. And as I say in my own publications, if a university had that sort of progression rate, we'd close it down pretty fast. So it's a good refutation of brainwashing theory. But also, it goes to show that critics tend to latch on to their ideas and not let them go. Brainwashing theory is still alive and well, unfortunately, in the anti-cult movement.
Yeah, and interestingly, it's becoming more popular in terms of the political sphere with folks like Steve Hassan applying it to trying to explain the Trump popularity and that phenomenon. So.
Well, yeah, that's true. That it tends to have kind of expanded. One colleague I know says, well, that's because the anti-cult people have kind of run out of ideas, that in order to show it's rife, you've got to find new areas in which brainwashing occurs. So you've got educational groups, you've got self-help groups, you've got political groups like Hassan on the cult of Trump. And yeah, this is another way of saying, well, brainwashing is quite widespread.
One of the things I hope that this conversation can do is to take the results, the scholarship on field work, and it can be looked at by evangelicals and other Christians to help give them a broader more layered understanding of new religious movements. You talk about this in your book, that there is Walter Martin's Kingdom of the Cults, and that kind of symbolized, still even today, it's still looked to as kind of the template for many conservative evangelicals and fundamentalists, where they use a text-based comparative doctrinal template. Here's what Christians believe from the Bible. Mm. Here's what a given group believes, and therefore it's cultic, and we'll try, we disagree with it, and we refute it. So it's a very limited kind of understanding. Mm. Why is that text-based doctrinal template limited and perhaps even inappropriate, and what might fieldwork do to help give us a richer, more in-depth understanding of new religions?
Yeah, I don't know how much field work, if any, Walter Martin did. Hmm. I mean, part of the problem with books like that is that they cover such a wide range of what we prefer to call new religious movements that you couldn't possibly do field work on all of them. So many people, including, I suspect, Walter Martin, were doing it on the basis of the literature that they read, watched her publications. I don't know whether any Jehovah's Witnesses came to Walter Martin's door. I don't think he tells us whether they did or not, but you could get these kind of casual acquaintances with new religious movements. So your base was very limited, and it would be based on the textual material rather than the lived religion. So a lot of what I've learned from Jehovah's Witnesses, which is the movement I've focused on in my writing, what you do learn is how they actually understand scriptures, how they answer questions you've got about them. Because when you ask probing questions, they don't say, oh gosh, I never thought of that. I don't know if you're familiar with Jack Chick's cartoons.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So they're pretty nasty, most of them, but invariably, they're cartoons about Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons. These are his main two targets when he's not dealing with Muslims or occultists. The JWs and Mormons that feature in his work seem to get very easily persuaded that they've got it wrong. And it's not like that at all. If you say, I asked them this recently, when you look at the Bible, Noah's Ark must have been half the size of the Queen Elizabeth. So how did a small family manage to build that? So they don't say, oh, gosh, never thought of that. Mm-hmm. They say things like, well, when you look at the age that Noah was, he had a huge number of years to do it. Right, now, you may not necessarily accept that answer, but it's not a bad answer. And fieldwork enables you to probe these sorts of questions and to see that generally people that subscribe to a minority faith often understand it particularly well. And they do so because they've actively converted to it. Not perhaps like your average nominal Christian has just kind of drifted into church now and again and probably doesn't understand the key ideas in the Bible or theological doctrines and would be very easily floored if you started probing.
In my experience, many Christians not only disagree with many new religions, but there's a certain level of fear associated with that. And I wonder sometimes if the text, comparative text-based approach helps solidify or create that. Is there a sense, do you have a sense, I don't know that you even talk about this in the book, but is there a sense that maybe fieldwork helps humanize or rehumanize rather than simply looking at texts worth ideas that you disagree with and find heretical? Doing fieldwork, you're actually engaging human beings living out their religious tradition.
Yes, absolutely. I think with Walter Martin, it's not altogether obvious why he wrote that book, because I don't really know of people that have been in a new religious movement. I've read about one or two, but it's not very common for somebody to read Walter Martin and to say, oh, I'm a Jehovah's Witness, now I see that I've got it all wrong. It doesn't seem to work that way. So What's he doing? Why is this kind of polemic against new religions so popular? And I suppose part of the reason, well, part of the reason is that people are curious, and you've got a wide variety of groups in the kingdom of the cult that are made accessible. They're not dealt with in any kind of detail. The discussion's not always 100% accurate. It's also readable, which is more than can be said, I've got to say, about a lot of academic writing. We're often accused of being obscure. And I'm really pleased when people say, your writing is really lucid, or I can really understand what you're saying, because I don't want to wrap it up in obscure jargon. So I think that's partly why people like Walter Martin score with the public. It's readable. I think also it's a means of enabling Christians to understand their own faith, because if you say that Jehovah's Witnesses embrace adoptionism or Arianism or whatever, these are not totally accurate criticisms, by the way, but it does enable Christians to say, well, I've got to give Jesus a higher status than is being given by the Mormon Church or the Watchtower Society. And that way you get to understand your own faith better by looking to the side and seeing how other groups understand it. So I think there's that purpose in it.
It's not only a text-based approach, but it's also the stories of ex-members are also a source that many Christians go to, and they consider them authoritative. How might field work help put these stories in perspective in terms of insider-outsider dynamics?
Yeah, I think we've got problems about ex-member testimony. One of the things I'd really like to do is to kind of get into the middle between the ex-member, the member, and then the people that just kind of drift along in a religious group. Because, as I say in the fieldwork book, I'm very conscious that when I go along to a Kingdom Hall meeting, it's me that's doing the observing. I'm dealing with what they show me. So it's the people that turn up that I'm seeing. So what about the people that don't turn up? I mean, what about the people that maybe come along sort of once a year to the memorial service? What are they like? How do they understand their faith? And it's very hard to get at them. I hear stories about witnesses that don't altogether embrace the teachings of the Watchtower Society, and it would be really interesting if we could find them and get their story. Now, you asked about the ex-member story. The ex-member story, I think, is worth listening to. I think one's got to be critical about it because ex-members can learn their stories from each other. And you very often it's a kind of consensus story that you're getting. It's also not a typical story because if it were the true story, there would be no one left in the organizations that they're criticizing. They also don't define their religion because, in the sense that if I'm contributing to a university prospectus, for instance, I don't go to all the failies and the people that have dropped out and say, please, can we have your testimony about York St. John University or the University of Wolverhampton, where I taught? They've got a point of view, but they don't define the organization. And the thing about ex-members is that the ones we hear are the vocal ones. They want to kind of shout about how and why they left the organization. But one has also got to remember that there is a silent majority. Now, the silent majority is probably quite a large majority. And occasionally you come across them. I was getting my hair cut on one occasion, and my hairdresser said that, well, she asked what I did, and I told her, and she said, oh, I used to go along to the Soka Gakkai. So I said, well, why did you leave? And her story was quite boring, really. It was she didn't like being out at night. So you're not going to get that as the subject matter of an anti-cult book, but it's a human story and it's one that's worth listening to. So I think one's got to put the ex-member testimony in context.
Yeah, that's very helpful. It's interesting how popular the ex-member testimonies are. And within evangelicalism, ex-members are often viewed as experts in the whole tradition they came out of, maybe even beyond that. So you have former psychics who are experts not only in psychics, but all of the occult and this type of thing. So it is an interesting phenomenon in itself. It would make for an interesting program just to discuss the ex-member testimony issue.
Yes, very much so. The ex-members will often say, "Well, I've heard both sides. I've been in and I've been out." But then most of the people that have been in have been out before they came in. So, you've got insiders and outsiders on both sides, really.
Let's talk a little bit about the ethics involved in doing field work. I remember many years ago, an evangelical apologist working in new religions who expressed concern about an academic working in the field in terms of the proximity he had to paganism in his research. And I think the concern was that he was too close and was compromised and didn't recognize it. Can you speak to the ethics involved in this kind of research?
Yeah, well, I think there are a lot of ethical dimensions. How involved should you be is a question that we sometimes discuss. I think well, one of the risks with one particular group that has offered me trips and even payment for writing articles is that I'm concerned that if I go along too far with this, I might be writing their theology and legitimizing them. And I'm kind of drawing back on that because I don't want to do that. Sometimes new religious groups have offered free accommodation and attendance fees at conferences that they've organized. How far along the road one goes, I think, is controversial. I know some of my critics will say you shouldn't do that. On the other hand, it's part of the phenomenon as well that I think we ought to be looking at. So I guess we all make up our own mind about these matters. I think the key question is this going to influence what I write about the group? Am I putting myself in a position where I'm kind of morally obliged to tell a favorable story when I might want to kind of hold back a bit? I think that's what we need to bear in mind. And I think one needs to exercise a certain amount of care on that one.
One final question for you, George. Given the conservative Christian interest primarily in a comparative doctrinal approach with an eye towards heresy and apologetics, this kind of framework that you've already said, we've acknowledged it does have a limited understanding of new religious movements. What case would you make for why they ought to consider looking at field work as a way of trying to expand their understanding of new religions?
Yes, so you said you were going to ask me about lay field workers. I think you put it in our communications.
Okay, yeah,
So
go ahead and tackle that one first.
so I'll give that a bit of thought. I think that I don't think there's anything wrong with going along out of curiosity to a meeting. I think it's sometimes advisable to make your purpose clear, because I remember once being at a meeting where they said halfway through, "Now I'm going to interview you to see whether you're ready for our form of meditation." And I knew that this would be quite expensive. And the guide didn't give people an opportunity to have a break at that point. So fortunately, I had said, "Well, I'm here just out of interest. I'm a university lecturer." And I was able to say, "Well, at this point, what I told you. I think I'll have to leave right now." Somebody else came out with me, which I was pleased to see, because he might well have been lured into kind of paying for this course that might have been a benefit, but I certainly didn't want to go along with it. So I think making your purpose clear is important. I think that you can certainly go along as a tourist to places of worship, and lots of people do that. The other form of lay field work, if you want to call it that, is the interfaith movement. It's not uncommon, and it's a pretty good idea, really, to go on a visit to another place of worship, whether it's another traditional religion or whether it's a new religion. I think one difference that maybe I should highlight is that these forms of field work are meant to be enjoyable. You enjoy your interfaith encounters. I know one colleague, when we were writing a book on the study of religion, he wanted to say it's important that you enjoy your field work. And yeah, I mean, I enjoy it most of the time, but sometimes I don't. And I could name a number of experiences where it's been embarrassing or it's been profoundly boring. And I won't name the groups in question, but I think my worst experience was attending a prayer meeting, which was done in darkness with just candlelight and lasted for a full 3.5 hours, would you believe? And people were praying, going into tears, and it was embarrassing. It was boring to me. Actually, what was interesting was that after the meeting, people were saying how much they had benefited from it and how beneficial, how enjoyable it had been. But as the outsider, I was thinking the total opposite. So I think when you do field work from an academic point of view, with the agenda of understanding a religion in some depth, one's got to be prepared for that as well. It's not all fun. And I discourage students from calling it field trips. Sometimes when you I've taken them on a field visit that's lasted a couple of weeks, has been sort of residential. Students have sometimes talked as if it's a holiday, and sometimes they've actually used that word. And I've had to say to them, well, okay, you're allowed to enjoy it, but don't make people think you're just having fun, because it's not fun all the time, it's work.
Yeah, I appreciate those comments. I benefited years ago when I was in seminary. We had an assignment in, I can't remember if it was one of our cultural studies courses, to go do some field work with a local religious group. And I went to seminary in Utah, and I had been involved in Mormon studies for a number of years, but wanted to do something different. And I established contact with some local pagans of the heathenry tradition, and they gave permission for me to come and watch one of their gatherings, and it was a fascinating experience. I learned a lot and can develop relationships that have continued over the years, so it certainly can provide some benefits. To branch off that to what I asked you a few moments ago, what kind of case would you make for why this can be a helpful thing for Christians? Doesn't have to be fearful, where it can help them understand, have a broader understanding of their new religious movements of their neighbors.
Yeah, I think that it is important to understand that there are people of different persuasions from ourselves, and also that they're human. More often than not, they're intelligent people. And I think it's important not to treat them as some do, as if they're kind of mentally subnormal. It's very easy to think that if you adopt a certain understanding of the Bible or of the world or whatever, then you must be brainwashed into it, or you must be pretty gullible, or you must be vulnerable. These are all terms that tend to get used by the critics. But it may sometimes be the case that vulnerable people feel that they can be helped by a particular group. But I think most of the time, people simply are attracted by the group that they choose to join. And I think as Christians, it's important to have a kind of general understanding of the world and to be able to represent people's belief systems fairly rather than to prejudge them or to misconstrue them. So, yeah, I think there is value in going to see what pagans do, what Unification Church members do, what Mormons do, and so on.
Well, George, I appreciate you taking the time from the UK, and I'm glad our schedules were able to coordinate here. Your book and your scholarship is wonderful as always. Again, the book is Fieldwork in New Religious Movements, and we'll have a link in the podcast notes. And George, I want to thank you so much for making the time and coming to have the conversation.
Well, thank you very much. The last time I looked at the Cambridge University website, although the period had expired to get your free copy, it still seemed possible. So,
Okay.
if viewers want to have a look at Cambridge and see whether it's still there, or have a look at my own website, which is www.religion21.com, then you can get information about the availability of books.
Wonderful. I'll include links to both of those in the program notes that folks can follow through with and take a look at. George, thank you again.
Well, thanks again for the invitation.
Again, this is the podcast for Multi-Faith Matters. Thanks to everybody for watching and listening. Until the next episode.